I don't want to refer one thing to something else in this hearing.
Oh, I think that's actually mine.
All right, we're back on the record. Mr. Seidels?
Quickly before we get started, Dam Hearing Examiner. So at the pre-hearing conference, you had said parties could submit a pre-hearing brief, which the appellants chose to do, or a post-hearing brief. And I just want to make it clear that the applicants were planning on submitting a post-hearing brief. Certainly, if we're going to have closing arguments here, I would like to participate, but just want to make sure that we'd still be allowed to file that post-hearing brief.
Okay. Why don't I remember saying that you could do one or the other? I usually don't do that.
Madam Examiner, I don't remember you saying that either. I remember you saying pre-hearing brief by January 9th.
Right. And I believe I mentioned post-hearing brief at the time.
Okay.
And you said you could do one but not the other. I haven't re-listened to the audio transcript, but that was my recollection. I know the pre-hearing conference order did not address dates for either of them, so...
Well, she addressed them verbally during the pre-hearing conference.
Well, exactly. And I don't know if the city has recollection on that.
I don't recall specifically what was said.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell you that you'll need to get it in a week. No more than that.
We'll make that work.
All right.
Thank you.
And if the city's going to do a brief, you can do the same thing.
And so, Madam Examiner, in that case, since now there's new briefing that we weren't expecting, we would like a chance to reply to that.
There's not going to be any replies because usually we have briefing coming in all at the same time. And so if you want to do more briefing, you can, although you've done a lot.
It's not a brief brief.
Yeah. If you want to do more briefing, you can, and get it in by the 18th as well.
Okay, but not in reply to that.
Right.
Okay, all right.
I would just restate for the record, it's my recollection that it was stated you could do one or the other, but not both. But I
don't recall that, so I'm just going to say we can all do briefs at the same time. All right, Mr. Seidels.
All right. As I said in my brief introduction, Madam Examiner, this case really turns on the question of what it takes to establish a separate building site. And I think it's helpful to turn to the text of the ordinance itself. Which says the historic lot exception may be applied to allow separate development of lots already in existence if the lot has an area of at least 2,500 square feet and was established as a separate building site in the public records of the county or city prior to 1957 by deed, platting, or building permit. That's the text that we're dealing with here. And the question is, what does it take, given this text, to establish a separate building site? As he briefly mentioned in his introduction, the counsel for the respondent here says establish just means create. With all due respect, I think that that's not the most reasonable interpretation of what this ordinance is calling for. It's important to bear in mind that this is an exception to the normal zoning rule. The normal rule would be that a house could not be constructed in this SF 5000 zone on a 3,100 square foot lot. So the developer and the department are attempting to invoke an exception and say, oh no, the normal rules ought not to apply here. We're going to call out this exception. I think when you are asking for an exception to the normal process, you have an obligation to meet a higher than usual standard. If you're asking for different treatment than a lot would normally receive, you have to show quite clearly that this lot was actually there back in historic times and that someone was going to build on it. It's not just enough to say that this was, you know, separate in some sense. It must also be a separate building site. And there's a case to that effect, the Dan Duffus case, in which the Court of Appeals said, you know, separate site is not the same thing as separate building site. Show us where it says building. So that's the standard that, in what I think is the best reading of the law, that's the standard that has to be met here. They can absolutely build if there's a separate building site, not merely a separate site, and if it's established clearly in the records so that anyone could look at this record and say, oh, yes, there it is right there, a separate building site. In terms of how you go about establishing that, as we see in the ordinance, there's three different types of documents: deeds, plats, and building permits. The city has already conceded that there's no deed here or plat. Everything hinges on the 1930 building permit. They can't use the sewer cards, as Mr. Graves said. If you're going to establish this separate building site, it all comes down to what the building permit actually says. So I'd like to address the specific facts in this case, and I think it would be helpful just to see how this proposed lot came into existence. So with your permission, I'd like to put up a demonstrative that is a not-to-scale, not-professional survey sketch of this property. I've got a fairly large one here. And then just kind of walk through the history of this. So I'll put it on this whiteboard so we can all, some of us anyway, can see it.
Would you like an easel? Or do you like me to get
the easel? Yeah, an easel's going
to
need.
Yeah, we might have to easel it. Oh, that's great.
Case where the admitted attorney carries the briefcase for the
law school student, as it should be.
All right. we've got a lot of recovering attorneys.
Yeah. So here's the lay of the land, and it'd be nice to keep the microphone with me, but I'll go off mic to walk.
No, you won't. You'll have a
oh my goodness.
We've got a mic for you. Okay.
All right. Okay, good. So in 1913 is when this original portion was platted, this J. Haynesworth addition to the city of Seattle. This is in West Seattle. And there were a whole bunch of plats created at that time, but the relevant ones are plats numbers 13, 14, 15, and 16, which I've outlined in black here. And those came into the possession of a Mr. Coulthard, who I'm just calling the 1930 building owner. That way we don't have to keep straight a bunch of names. So he had these four plats, which were totally undeveloped when he got them. In 1930, he applied for a building permit to put up a house which still stands today. The address is 3038 39th Avenue Southwest. This is the 1930 building permit that's at issue in this case, the one that was introduced by the department in their exhibits. And like all building permits, this one had a section on it that said lot description. And he described the lot as, you know, a plat 16 and the southern 8 1/3 feet of a plat 15. I've drawn this blue line here to indicate the line that was described in that building permit. It said nothing else, didn't say a word about the remainder of the property. All it did was build a house right here, and we heard testimony to that effect as well. You know, the 1930 building permit is for this house, not for any other. Shortly thereafter, still in 1930, the 1930 building owner deeded this northern portion to someone else. The name's not important, but it's Arkell. And that house still stands today as well. It's at 3030 right here. And here's the line that got put down for a deed, and that deed describes, you know, this lot. So that establishes a lot right there. It's very unequivocal. I'm selling you this portion. So at the end of these two 1930 transactions, you had a building permit that addressed this house, and a deed and subsequent building permit that addressed this house, and nothing at all that addressed this blank middle portion. Shortly after that, still in 1930, the 1930 building owner sold off his remaining interest, which at this point was just the part outlined in green. He sold that by deed in a single transaction. The deed said, here is the lot that I'm selling you, and the lot description there was the green outline. It was everything. It was this house. It was this undeveloped yard. It was everything, all in a single deed. Then in 1937, the purchaser of that sold it again, and then there's been a subsequent chain of transactions, at least 10 of them that we're aware of, from 1930 till now, every time selling this lot as a single lot, not as two. And the tax records say the same thing. This lot has paid taxes as a single lot as well. So the only document that even hypothetically could create a separate buildable lot in this northern half, this side yard, is the 1930 building permit itself. There's just not any other deed or building permit or anything else, no document that speaks explicitly to this. The closest we have is a document that speaks explicitly to the very southern half. Everything else has been silent. So the question for you now becomes, is that enough to establish a separate building site? Given these facts and these documentation that's been introduced, do you look at that and say, yep, that's it. He was definitely planning to build a house right there. Anybody could see that. Can you establish a building site using documents that don't actually speak to that site? We believe that the answer is no. As discussed in the brief, I cite to some other cases in which judges have had to interpret, you know, what does it mean when a law calls for something to be established? And in those cases, quite consistently in various jurisdictions and over a great length of time, courts have said, if you're going to call something established, you have to be really quite certain that it's true. It has to be unambiguous, unequivocal, you know, plain on its face. That's when we'll say that something is established. But if it's ambiguous, if it's vague, then you're not dealing with an established fact. You're dealing with something that you know could be argued. And in fact, we are here arguing about what this means because it is ambiguous. If there was a building permit that said we're building a third house right here, there'd be nothing to argue about. But because we're not dealing with that, there is a scope for argumentation.
Are you finished with the board?
I'm finished with the board, yes, okay. Yes, Madam Examiner.
We're going to take your microphone back, and you need to sit down.
In terms of what this law was trying to do, I think it's helpful to point to some of the testimony that we heard from the department staffers. Because they're right. Back in the old days, there were no zoning laws. You know, people could just sort of build willy-nilly. They still needed building permits. They still needed deeds if they were going to transfer. But there was no rules on what your lot size could be in a given neighborhood. That began to change in the 1950s when zoning started to come in, and a bunch of property owners said, oh my goodness, I'm going to get zoned out of building a second house that I was planning to build all along. Now, there was a transition period. As we
said, facts not in evidence.
Well, let's look at the facts that were introduced. We had the ordinance from 1952, which was introduced, that said, here comes zoning. We're going to start, you know, restricting what can be built where. Now, the historic lot exception says if you were established prior to 1957, and your lot is clearly established, you can still build on it. So there's a certain grace period there where property owners know zoning is coming in. If you're going to try to grandfather your lot in, you better get out there and make sure that lot is established, because very soon you're not going to be able to build willy-nilly. So given that, and that's very sensible public policy, we don't want people who've had a nest egg property to lose it when the law suddenly changes on them. But we also want the law to have real effect. You know, just because you have a large parcel somewhere does not mean that you get to flout the zoning laws. People in the 1950s were on notice that the law was changing, and if they wanted to enjoy grandfathering, if they wanted to enjoy the fruits of their investment, they had better act quickly to clarify their rights. If they slept on their rights and did not clarify them, there's a real chance that any notional building lot could be taken away. And I believe that's what's happened here. There are, on top of all of this, there are questions of fairness surrounding this entire case. Is it fair to allow a vague and ambiguous document from 1930 to control our actions 86 years later? Across 86 years, across at least 10 changes of ownership, there was ample opportunity to either build on this notional lot, to sell it off separately, to prior to the 1950s to clarify it when it became obvious that zoning was coming in. Lots and lots of chances for many of these people to take action, and they never did. At some point, you have to say, you know, in the minds of the people who knew it best, the owners, this was not a separate buildable site. I mean, the 1930 building permit just wasn't clear enough to let them do anything of that nature. The type of people that this ordinance seeks to protect are those types of people, the types who may have wanted to build something as a nest egg, not subsequent real estate agent or real estate developers who came in decades after the fact to try to buy one of these things and develop on it. This is very clear in one of the exhibits that's been admitted. This plaintiff's exhibit N, whatever number that corresponds to, Richard Conlon's email on historic lots, in which he says, we're trying to restrict the different documents that can be used to establish these things because real estate developers are taking advantage of loopholes, and that's not what this is for. This is not a loophole for developers. It's intended to preserve the rights of people who had property long ago. That's not what's going on here. We heard argument a little bit about the purchase price of the house, which was $515,000 in 2015. That's a very fair purchase price for one house in West Seattle, but it's not a very fair purchase price for one house plus a building lot right next door.
Objection, facts not in evidence.
Well, the purchase price is in evidence. It's in one of the plaintiff's exhibits on the sales history for tax parcels. Plaintiff's Exhibit F.
All right, and what you're doing is giving me your opinion about the fairness of the real estate market, or prices vis-a-vis the real estate market, which I haven't heard anything from as far as a real estate agent or anything like that.
That's right, Madam Examiner, and I'll withdraw my opinion on the correct price of the house, but the price of the house, I think, does speak for itself, so I won't attempt to speak for it further. There are other things than just the purchase price to indicate that this was not a separate lot. You know, as we've seen, the porch sticks across the line, as does the retaining wall. It doesn't make sense that someone who was planning to put another house in there would have put his porch there knowing that, you know, he was going to have to demolish it the minute he sold this thing, you know, and he did sell it mere months later. That's just not a sensible course of action. Likewise, the overall space for the house, and you'll see this when you do your site visit, Madam Examiner, the one that we discussed during the pre-hearing conference. There is not much room there for a house. These things are going to be wedged in chock-a-block, very different from all of the other houses that were built there during the 1930s. So that's another indicator that whatever this lot was going to be used for, it probably wasn't going to be a house, because why would they wedge them in so tightly when that wasn't their practice there? Finally, I would just say, as a matter of logic, this idea that the only logical reason to draft the 1930 building permit that way is to establish another house, I don't think that that's true. As we heard from Mr. McKim's testimony, the idea of the leftover pie piece, you know, where if you have documents for one part of the lot but not for the other, that creates a separate building site there. He was not able to point to anything in the law or in department policy written down that said that's the case. It's just his own practice to say, oh yes, they were going to build a house there. But you can think of other things that might have been put there that aren't houses. And in fact, the fact that 86 years have gone by without a house is an indicator that other uses were more likely than the proposed use of a house. To say that that's the only reason to do that, that's a fact that's not in evidence. We just don't know what the owner was going to do. There's not enough evidence now in 2017 to get inside his mind in 1930 and say, oh yes, he did this to make another building lot. Unless they can produce a document that says unequivocally, building site on this portion of the property, I would say that is not established in the records.
That's it? Okay, thank you. Mr. Mills?
Well, from the department's perspective, this is a fairly simple case. And I would start by reminding the examiner, as and she well knows, of what the standard of proof in a code interpretation is, that the standard is that the department gets weight on its opinion in a code interpretation, and therefore the burden of proof rests with the appellants to show that a clear mistake has been committed in our analysis. There's certainly no evidence that a mistake has been committed in the analysis in this case. In fact, the appellant's own arguments and their own illustrations, I think, demonstrate quite the opposite, that there is clearly a legal building site here established by building permit records. As the appellants noted in their arguments, yes, there's no evidence of a deed or of platting. We concede that this is not a platted lot. In fact, it's portions of two platted lots that make up the vacant lot under appeal. But the question that I think we have to ask is, were the lot lines in question legally drawn in the public record through the process allowed by the land use code for the historic lot exception? In 1930, when the lines were drawn for the property in question, there were no platting requirements. You could plat if you wanted to, and they did plat Ainsworth's addition. We see actually illustration of four lots here. There could have been four houses here in 1930, but the builders of these houses deliberately described lots that show something different. They show, again, by the appellant's own illustrations, they show that that a lot was drawn on lot 16 and a portion of 15. A second house was built on 13 and a portion of 14. Leaving a portion of 14 and a portion of 15 in the middle is an undeveloped lot. There's building permits for both the house to the north and the house to the south that draw the lines in question. Those lot lines around the subject property were therefore legally drawn in 1930, well before the minimum lot area exception. Now, there's been discussion of intent of the owner. We don't know what the intent of the owner was in 1930, but we do know what the building permits have to say, and those building permits have to stand for something, some kind of rational order of analysis of property. To take the appellant's suggestion that a higher standard should apply to the vacant lot and that we should somehow have to have additional evidence is an impossible standard, because by its very nature it's a vacant property, so of course there's no building permit. No building permit was ever issued for that vacant property that's now the subject of appeal. I don't think we can accept the idea that there has to be some additional record. If the property had been deeded, had been conveyed separately, we might be able to say, well, there's a title history as well. In this case, there was no separate title history, but we don't know why. We don't know what was in the mind of the property owner in terms of maintaining that property as a side yard all these years, nor should we inquire into that. We are looking at public records that are well-established and very clear. And so, yes, it rests on the building permits, and the department's comfortable with that, with both the letter that Mr. Graves wrote and the separate code interpretation that he wrote clearly state the basis for separation of this property. The appellants want to read, again, something into the code that's not there and impose a standard of review that is not in the code. The documents from 1930 are not vague. They're very clear, and they should control. I would also submit, particularly following the changes to the land use code in 2014, that there shouldn't even be any discussion of whether this is somehow continuing to be a loophole for developers, that there is clearly a deliberate policy intent of the council to preserve the ability to develop undersized lots, and that's clearly shown in the documents that the department provided discussing that policy, including the comprehensive plan, which today continues to provide for recognition of undersized and undeveloped property. The fact that the porch and the wall cross the line between the two portions of 15, that's addressed by the code. The porch is an unenclosed portion of the property that can be removed according to 2344.010b1. There's a section that allows the removal of minor encroachments. Now, if the foundation encroached or something like that, that's a different discussion, but we don't have that here. We have, instead, a minor encroachment. That's true of the retaining wall as well, which is an accessory structure. Accessory structures can cross lot lines. They can be removed in order to free up the vacant lot for development. So, again, we have a lot of argument here. We have a discussion about the meaning of the word establish. I think the applicant's attorney already mentioned that establish, this is not an evidentiary standard that we're talking about in the land use code. It's more a matter of describing what establish in 2344.010 means is more a description of the property in question in the public record. And I guess I'm not sure what more could be generated here to demonstrate that this is a more buildable lot than we've already determined. The fact that it's a somewhat narrow property, that too is irrelevant. So it's wide enough for a house meeting land use code development standards. You need a 5-foot side yard on either side, and it has adequate depth for front and rear yards and a house in a principal building area. I would also note that there's, I believe, discussion in some of the materials in the record that it's not that unique. There's a neighborhood here of houses built on smaller lots. The houses to the north and south aren't on full-size lots either, I don't believe. They may be somewhat larger than the lot in question, but not something different. So the department's opinion is that the legal building site letter and interpretation should be upheld. There is no basis for reversing and saying that this particular lot does not qualify as a separate legal building site in the public records. Again, based on pretty clear building permit history.
Thank you.
I'll keep this brief, Madam Hearing Examiner. So I believe the appellant is correct, and you must look at what the code says. And what it says is the historic lot exception may be applied to allow separate development of lots already in existence if the lot has an area of at least 2,500 square feet and was established as a separate building site in the public records of the county or city prior to July 24th, 1957 by deed, platting, or building permit. I think it's undisputed there's a building permit that refers to Lot A and carves out that portion of Lot B. Now, the appellants try and argue that this is some sort of high evidentiary standard that's found nowhere in the code. There is no Washington case law or hearing examiner's decisions in support of that statement. What they do have is they have a United States Supreme Court that concerns black lung and, I believe, a unpublished Kansas decision referring to DUIs. If you look at the current Merriam-Webster's dictionary, I have copies, but I believe you can take judicial notice of it. One of the definitions of establish is to bring into existence. Now, if you look at the ordinance and how it's been consistently applied throughout by the city, looking back at, I believe, the four opinion letters that were submitted, the permit is what establishes it. There's no additional higher standard that's attached to that. As alleged by the appellants. Now, as you, I believe you said during opening remarks, that substantial deference must be given to the city's decision. I don't believe you heard the words arbitrary or capricious in relation to the city's decision during the closing statements. There was a lot of what ifs. Well, maybe the prior owners were thinking of doing this. Just because there's two possible outcomes does not mean their decision is arbitrary and capricious. I think there's substantial case law on that, and I will be providing it in our closing statements. Now, if you look at the lovely diagram they created here, you have essentially three lots, what I refer to as Lot A, Lot B, Lot C, going from the right to the left. What you have here is three equal lots in size that the city testified to. You have a house on Lot A and a house on Lot C. So I think from a purely visual perspective, it's clear that Lot B was retained, and if you were to develop a house there, it would fit in perfectly with both the property to the right and the property to the south and the property to the north. In addition to the building permit, there were other documents that specifically referred to Lot A. Now, again, when the city applied the building permit that carved out the leftover piece, that's been applied throughout. Now, what the appellant suggests here concerning how the city is applying this has more to do with legislative action. If they're not happy with the code, certainly people can petition their legislatures and have that code changed. But the code, as it's written and as it's been consistently interpreted, provides that if a building permit carves out a section by not referring to it, that is sufficient to create a separate legal building site.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any closing briefs are due on the 18th, and I will get you a decision after that. Thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Hearing Examiner. Would that be by 5 p.m.?
Yes.
And that's